Welcome to the April 2022 Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast, in which Hugh Myers discusses historical perspectives from the newly formed collection of rare books and manuscripts at the ACU. Mr. Myers is introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody.
Today's presentation is by Hugh Myers, who's Specials Collections Advisor to the Australian Catholic University in Sydney. And what he's going to tell us about is a reminder that, as well as people, objects have history, and books are very important for historians in any case, but in terms of their own history. People have written books on the history of the book in Australia, and this is a very important subset of that topic. Hugh was born in Sydney, was educated at Fort Street High School in Sydney, one of the selective high schools at which I've had two grandchildren and a father-in-law and his brother. So I'm very well aware of the distinction of somebody who's been educated at Fort Street. And then did a BA at the University of Sydney and a Master of Arts in Anthropology at Macquarie University. Then he worked in the rare book trade, as he said, was his one and only job until Greg Craven, the recently retired Vice-Chancellor of the ACU, decided that the library at that university needed to take books, particularly older books, and older books of an historical and artistic kind, much more seriously. I don't know how much Hugh will touch on this, but Sydney is incredibly well served in this regard. Naturally, with the State Library, it's wonderful to see Paul Brunton here today, where there's a remarkable collection of rare books, but some that I discovered some years ago when I was making a program for ABC Radio, an illustrated hymnal from Rimini. They have a wonderful collection of Bibles, which were given, some of which were given to the library by an English collector after World War I, because he was so impressed by the calibre of the Australian soldiers who were camped on his estate in England that he wanted to do something for the colony, and he donated this extraordinary collection of Bibles to the State Library. But in addition to that, there's the collection in the Veitch Library, for example, and the rare books collection at the University of Sydney and Fisher Library. So we're very, very lucky in to have a lot of the material that we have. There is a history of the book, and to some extent, I'm sure that Hugh will touch on that today. We've passed around a sheet which he prepared to let people know how to contact him and how to visit the collection. But it's a great pleasure to welcome you. Your title is Historical Perspectives from the Newly Formed Collection of Rare Books and Manuscripts at the ACU. Welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity to present this lecture to the Catholic Historical Society. And my special thanks to you to Dr. Carmody for his assistance in making this presentation possible. This lecture was delivered online during the lockdown last year to the Ashling Society and is here presented with some revisions and incidental ruminations. Now, before I begin, I'd like to just pass around two books. This afternoon, I will talk about the role of religion and social conflict in early colonial New South Wales, Norfolk Island and Van Diemen's Land, with a special emphasis on the experiences of men and women who were transported from Ireland and how they were treated during this period. Since 2017, I've been employed as Special Collections Advisor to the Australian Catholic University in North Sydney and have been tasked with assembling a collection of books, manuscripts and historical artefacts on the history of the Catholic Church in Australia. This project was initiated by the former Vice-Chancellor, Professor Greg Craven, who wished to create a special collection to preserve the history of Australian Catholicism. Now, before commencing the primary presentation on Irish convict history, it would be fruitful to tell members of this historical society a little more about the collection, with a view to shedding some light on how and why books were printed in early colonial Australia. Relationships between printing and the distribution of books and pamphlets do influence our capacity to understand the social environment of Australia during the era of transportation. First of all, a little about my background and how I came into the role of building a rare book library at the ACU. I've worked for over 20 years as a professional antiquarian book dealer, and during this time was employed by several Sydney booksellers, including Richard Nailon and Horden House. Some of you may remember Richard Nailon's bookshop in St John's Road in Glebe. This is going back some years now. But any of you who are book collectors would probably remember Richard. And then he moved to rural Tasmania to commence an entirely online business. So Richard is an excellent rare book dealer, being a reclusive misanthrope with a dry wit that make his catalogues unusually interesting and humorous. And Horden House have been long established as the preeminent antiquarian booksellers in Australia and enjoy an international reputation for books on voyages, exploration and the history of science. I worked for this company for a decade, and much of this was in bibliographic research and writing the detailed catalogues for which this company is renowned. During this time, I was fortunate to handle many books printed in early colonial Australia and gained some familiarity with the early history of the colony. While working at Horden House, I met Professor Greg Craven, who was then acting as the Vice-Chancellor of the ACU, and he's a dedicated book collector and bibliophile himself. And in 2017, I returned to full-time study, commencing a two-year Masters by Research degree at the Department of Social Anthropology at Macquarie University. So when I commenced studies, Professor Craven invited me to begin building the new collection of Catholic history books and manuscripts at the Australian Catholic University. This collection is now in its fifth year of development and numbers over 1,700 items, encompassing books, pamphlets, manuscripts, printed ephemera, historical artefacts and curios. As far as I know, this is the only institutional collection in Australia assembled by a former professional antiquarian bookseller. Much of it has been purchased from other book dealers, but I also spend a good deal of time and energy surveying auctions in Australia, Europe and North America. A smaller portion of the books have been donated to the collection, and I sincerely hope that significant donations continue in the coming years. From the outset, the intention has been to create an archive of Australian social history relating to Catholic people. As such, it is not just a dry ecclesiastic and theological library, although these subjects are certainly included. Written material by interesting and significant Australian Catholics is actively sought, and this often includes literature, scientific publications and non-religious books. The date range commences in the late 18th century with the La Perouse priests and continues to the present day. However, being an antiquarian book dealer by profession, my inclination is towards rare 19th century printing, especially what would now be called ephemera or occasional printing. This includes pamphlets, broadsides, posters, handbills, chapbooks, political flyers, and such printed material that typically has a very poor survival rate over time. Sometimes such items are unrecorded by historians and bibliographers, and finding them in the first place requires considerable patience and experience. In colonial Australia, pamphlets were a common way of disseminating information, especially when the subject at hand was immediate and contentious, and religion was one such point of regular conflict. So in this presentation, I'd like to provide some insights into the experience of Irish convicts, and to do this, I will draw upon careful reading of a small number of books and pamphlets from the collection at the Australian Catholic University. It's not my intention to provide a comprehensive history of convict transportation from Ireland to Australian to the Australian colonies, but rather to use some carefully selected primary sources to give a sense of why ethnicity and religion were so terribly important in early colonial society. And this brings me back to the ephemeral pamphlets and occasional printing already mentioned. When we survey Australian 19th century printing related to religion, three types of material are readily apparent. First of all are the Catholic books written by priests and prominent lay advocates of the church. Second are the written productions of the hierarchy of the Church of England. Given this was the preferred religion endorsed by the government in colonial Australia, there is some overlap between religious and bureaucratic or administrative printing. That is where it relates to the activities of priests and members of the Church of England. And third are the Protestants, including Congregationalists, Calvinists, Presbyterians, and all manner of irregular evangelicals. What I quickly discovered is that there is far more Protestant religious printing in colonial Australia. A lot more, in fact. And there is a fairly simple explanation for why this is the case. Furthermore, intense sectarian rivalries are evident in Protestant printing in 19th century Australia. It is routinely anti-Catholic and specifically anti-Irish, often written for maximum effect with ample bombast, vitriol and libel. To our eyes, it appears defamatory and even downright racist, going so far as to depict the Irish as spiritually and constitutionally inferior to the other peoples of Great Britain. Sectarianism, especially the Catholic-Protestant divide, has long been a source of bitter contention in Australian society. Indeed, it continued into the 20th century and was certainly a major social division in the early life of my parents' generation, that is, those born in the 1940s and 1950s. It was only in the mid to late 1970s that Australian ecclesiastics made peace across the lines, and the issue of religious affiliation is no longer divisive and acrimonious in the same way as experienced by past generations. Most of this is not lost on the present audience because you actually lived through this process and were born into the generation I'm talking about. But in colonial Australia, religious identity mattered a great deal. This was in large part due to the significant proportion of convicts who came from Ireland, the large majority of whom were Catholic. But I digress from a question already posed. Why did colonial Protestants print so much compared to Catholics and Anglicans? The hierarchy of the Church of England were associated with the government, being the priests of the official Christian religion of the colony. As such, they were disinclined to enter into controversy and political matters, as it would complicate the role of the Anglican Church relative to the administrative authority of the state. Conversely, the Catholic Church has a long-standing mechanism to keep its priests from entering public political conflict. This is achieved by the official approval of Catholic publications by a censor and a bishop, or the appointed emissary of a bishop. Incidentally, and this is relevant to the history of colonial New South Wales, the vicar apostolic could also be was also able to approve a book or a pamphlet for publication. That's relevant because Poling is the first bishop, and before the mid-30s, Australia... It's too complex to get into, but you'll get it. You more or less understand what I'm talking about. Any book authorised by a priest in his role as a representative of the church requires this official endorsement before it can be printed. These may be familiar to you as the Nihil Obstat and Imprimatur on the reverse page, on the reverse of the title page of a Catholic book. Nihil Obstat literally means no obstruction and indicates the approval of a censor who has read the book and declared it free from doctrinal error or fallacy. The imprimatur is the endorsement of the bishop and means to be printed. So, ministers and deacons of the Church of England were tied to the temporal government of the colony, and Catholic priests were beholden to the universal government of the Catholic Church. However, the Protestant evangelists had no such constraints and could print relatively quickly and without bureaucratic hindrance. Generally speaking, they were accountable to their own congregations and not to larger powers or principalities. Within the isolated and parochial context of the Australian colonies, personal charisma played a large part in the power and influence wielded by Protestant pastors over their congregations. These factors help us understand why there is so much Protestant printing in colonial Australia, and why it is often fiery, spontaneous, and idiosyncratic. And it is set against the Irish Catholic population of the colony, especially the convicts who never elected to come to Australia in the first place. And lastly, it is worth noting that there is more Protestant printing in colonial Australia for the simple reason that there are more Protestant ministers than Catholic priests. As we shall see, the Catholic Church was relatively slow to consolidate an ecclesiastic presence in Australia. So, in assembling this new rare book collection, I have learned that some of the most informative and important early printed material on Australian Catholicism was written by enemies of the Church and not by supporters of it. Furthermore, the whole issue of being a Catholic in colonial Australia was intimately tied to Irish national identity. Prejudice against the Irish merges with a rejection of Catholicism as a legitimate religion. The issue of religion and ethnicity is seemingly inextricable, despite the fact that many Australian Catholics during colonial times were neither Irish nor transported convicts. And I think that is actually really quite an important point, that by the middle of the 19th century, this is the rough date range of the Protestant book that I've handed around amongst you, that many of the Catholics in Australia were not Irish and they were not transported convicts. They had elected to come here. And so the issue of ethnicity is a cloud that hangs over all of the Catholics in the colony on the basis of just the heat and the venom associated with transportation as a public discourse in New South Wales, particularly during the 1840s. Anyhow, I hope that I've given you a sense of this collection development project and would like now to move on to examining some of the wonderful rarities of the collection, especially those that relate to the conditions of Irish convicts. A few quick facts to introduce the subject. A total of approximately 165,000 people were transported to the Australian colonies, the vast majority being sent to New South Wales or Van Diemen's Land, being present-day Tasmania. The first convict transports marked the beginning of formal British settlement in 1788, and transportation to the eastern Australian colonies ceased in 1853. Convict transportation and assigned labour continued on a much smaller scale in Western Australia up until 1868. Approximately one-third of those transported were Irish. Political prisoners, specifically those who fought and agitated for Irish freedom, were actually in the minority, and it has been statistically demonstrated that less than 1% of convicts sent to Australia from across the British Empire were charged with crimes of a political nature, such as sedition, conspiracy, and so forth. And in giving that statistic, that kind of debunks a popular myth about convicts, but it is kind of quite a necessary correction to note. It's not quite as romantic as we want it to be. The overwhelming majority of Irish convicts were those convicted of stealing produce or livestock. They may not have been political prisoners in the formal sense of the word, but many were rendered poor and desperate by extractive English land ownership in Ireland. The sharp increase in rural poor transported to Van Diemen's Land in the 1840s reflects a steady deterioration of conditions arising from overpopulation, alienation of good arable land, and seemingly inescapable cycles of intergenerational poverty. This dire situation culminated in the Great Famine, when the potato blight struck Ireland with horrific consequences. It's a curious fact that prior to 1840, very few Irish convicts were sent to Van Diemen's Land. This may have been due to the political influence wielded by Lieutenant George Arthur in London. However, when transportation to New South Wales ceased in 1840, large numbers of Irish were sent to Van Diemen's Land. This trend increased throughout the 1840s due to the political unrest and the famine. As we shall see, the state of Catholic religion was poorly advanced in Van Diemen's Land, effectively leaving these convicts without proper access to organised religious services. The whole question of how and why George Arthur kept the Irish out of Van Diemen's Land is a very interesting one historiographically, and is actually a very significant one in terms of the Catholic history of Australia. What is significant is that when the transports stopped arriving in 1840 in New South Wales, the unrest in Ireland increased significantly, and the sheer number of convicts transported to Van Diemen's Land increased overall, and that's where the Irish were being sent for more than a decade, and the actual conditions of forced labour were harder and nastier than ever before in the history of transportation. We sort of think of the first 5 to 15 years of the colony as being the really rough time, and a lot of it was. But it was actually that last decade of transportation of desperately poor people from across Great Britain, but especially Ireland, to Van Diemen's Land, where the conditions were worse and there wasn't... economically, the colony was in a bad state, so there were less people to take ticket men as to take assigned labourers. So a lot of these poor from across Great Britain and Ireland were put in chain gangs and worked under really, really nasty conditions. Anyway, I digress. But I do think that is an interesting historiographic sort of focus for Australian Catholic history. Okay, moving on. The experience of convicts sent to the Australian colonies was varied. Those with skills like mechanics and builders fared relatively well, for they were assigned to masters who valued their labour. Unskilled agricultural labourers were sent to work for settlers who often treated them poorly, and this was the fate of many Irish convicts in Australia. Secondary punishment for re-offenders included road building and chain gangs, or being sent to the dreaded establishments at Norfolk Island and Port Arthur. One of the most powerful accounts of the Irish experience was written by the charismatic English Benedictine William Ullathorne. It is titled The Catholic Mission in Australasia and was published in 1837. This is one of the books that's circulating now. Ullathorne, as most of you will well know already, Ullathorne was a remarkable man who experienced a religious transformation in his youth. He was actually sent to sea as a boy, which is a sort of an interesting insight into English middle-class culture, that they would send a boy to sea as a midshipman. So Ullathorne experienced a religious transformation in his youth and trained as a Benedictine under John Bede Poulding, later the first Catholic bishop of New South Wales. Poulding and Ullathorne were committed to carrying out their mission to the convicts of Australia, and upon arriving in the colony in the mid-1830s, were shocked by the state of affairs that they encountered. What they found is that the vast majority of Irish Catholic convicts had little or no access to religion. Experience of Mass, sacrament and confession were uncommon, with a small number of priests in a colony of vast size and widely dispersed population. The situation in Van Diemen's Land was even worse, where the irascible Father Philip Connolly ministered from a slab hut during bitter winter cold and summer heat. In the early years of settlement, some attempt by the authorities had been made to provide Irish Catholic convicts with Christian influence in the form of Anglican service. But this was typically spurned or rejected, leaving thousands of convicts in an effectively irreligious state of existence. Eventually, permission was granted to allow Catholic priests in the colony, but not before covert attempts had been made to celebrate the Catholic religion in New South Wales. In his book, The Catholic Mission in Australasia, William Ullathorne describes one such renegade Irish priest. Ullathorne gives his identity as the Very Reverend Mr. Flynn, spelled F-L-I-N-N, but doubtlessly refers to Jeremiah Francis O'Flynn, spelt with a Y, who arrived in New South Wales in November 1817. Father O'Flynn sailed for New South Wales without permission from the colonial secretary and was promptly expelled by Governor Macquarie 7 months later. He conducted covert masses, baptisms and confession during his short stay, and famously left behind a loaf of sacramental bread for the faithful. Father O'Flynn had scant education and a poor grasp of the English language, but William Ullathorne makes specific mention of his fluent and eloquent Gaelic. He writes that one old convict hand told him Father O'Flynn, and I quote, had the sweetest and swiftest tongue of Irish that ever my ear heard, and that he had never spoken one word of English until it was made 50 lashes to speak a word of Irish. Such was the upset caused by the Reverend O'Flynn's expulsion from the colony that Governor Macquarie was induced to grant a small stipend to two priests. The legendary Father John Joseph Terry came to New South Wales, and Father Philip Connolly to Van Diemen's Land. But the resources of the two men were stretched thin. very thin indeed. William Ullathorne describes the pitiful condition of the Catholic religion in Hobart shortly after his arrival in the colony in the first months of 1833. And I quote, "One solitary priest has lived there alone for many years, without even the opportunity of meeting a brother priest. Not a single school. A wretched wooden shed on the outskirts of Hobart Town, placed high up on the side of a lofty hill. Not finished, no seat, not even a flooring board arranged and fastened, incapable of containing one half of the people. This was the only Catholic erection in Van Diemen's Land. Such a scene of religious desolation, of absolute desolation, has rarely been witnessed amongst a numerous Catholic population. The governor was a man of a pious turn of mind who thought religion and education of the utmost value to everyone but a Catholic." And you'll find that description on page 239 of the book that's circulating now. After more than a decade of toil, Father Connolly in Hobart took an instant dislike to William Ullathorne, who was not only unusually youthful in appearance, but also highly educated, eloquent, and a brilliant intellectual to match. On first meeting William Ullathorne, you can really imagine these veteran priests thinking, this is the most unsuitable person to send to a convict colony. He really looked like a teenager, even into his 20s. And he was superbly educated. Indeed, Ullathorne had brought a personal library of over 500 volumes with him to Australia. And some of those books are in the Veitch collection. Incidentally, I'm pleased to report that the Catholic University collection has recently acquired a book from the personal library of Philip Connolly, with the front end paper signed in full. This is a great rarity, as there is no evidence that Father Connolly owned an extensive library. Searching out books from the personal collections of early Catholic ecclesiastics has always been a collection development priority for me, and I've got a reasonable spread at the moment. Likewise, in New South Wales, the veteran priest John Joseph Terry was unimpressed by Ullathorne, but he quickly demonstrated a commitment to the convict mission that won over his detractors. And what a mission it was. Australians are now proud of their convict ancestry and have a somewhat sentimental view of life in early colonial Australia. This perspective is stripped bare when reading Ullathorne's account of the colony. He describes a society of moral inversion, a place rife with violence, chronic alcoholism, prostitution, and endemic criminality. It is, literally, an alarming description of human degradation and hopelessness. Although born in Yorkshire and an Englishman by birth, William Ullathorne is sympathetic to the plight of the Irish convicts among whom he ministered. Some mention has already been made of how many Irish convicts came from straitened rural circumstances. And on this subject, Ullathorne writes the following. Again, I quote, "For the year 1835, the entire number in actual bondage is, in New South Wales, nearly 30,000, while in Van Diemen's Land there are nearly 20,000, to which must be added 3,000 for the penal settlements of Norfolk Island, Moreton Bay and Port Arthur. It is to be further considered that the great proportion of free inhabitants of these colonies consists of emancipists from a similar condition of bondage, i.e. ex-convicts. Of all these, one-third are Irish Catholics, of whom many, if I except those in the large cities, have been transported for infringement of penal laws, for agrarian offences and minor delinquencies, while those from England are, with rare exceptions, punished for direct aggression on property or the person. As, however, there is no distinction in the degree of punishment, they become mingled, contaminated, and corrupted alike. That's actually a very sort of interesting and contentious assertion that he makes, that it's the English convicts who are corrupting these sort of the innocent Irish who have gone from this rural Arcadia, gone terribly wrong because of the landholders. Anyhow, but the most moving and persuasive sections of the Catholic mission in Australasia concern his two visits to Norfolk Island. A place of great worldly beauty hid glaring atrocity, where the worst convicts in the system preyed upon the weak. In only 22 days, Ullathorne heard some 450 confessions, and here he learned of unspeakable and sadistic crimes, many of a sexual nature. It's interesting that, because I've been collecting, obviously I buy everything that I can find on William Ullathorne, the pamphlets that he published in Sydney are so rare they're effectively unobtainable. But I've got a whole bunch of pamphlets that he printed while Bishop of Birmingham from the 50s, from the 1850s onwards. And that experience of taking those confessions on Norfolk Island, it reverberates through his writing for the rest of his life. It was a really formative experience. It was a really powerful experience for him as a priest and as a confessor. Okay. So Ullathorne published the Catholic mission in Australasia whilst on leave in England in 1837. It ran into multiple editions with thousands of copies printed in London, Liverpool and Dublin. It was translated into German, French, Italian and Dutch, four European languages, and over 80,000 copies were distributed on the continent. He reworked the text and published it under a different title. The alternate title is The Horrors of Transportation. That's how you may know this book. And in doing so, he disseminated thousands more copies. He even had the audacity to publish it in Sydney upon return to the colony, and sorely vexed a lot of people here in Sydney by doing so. In publishing this account of colonial Australia, William Ullathorne literally assaulted the moral conscience of British and European Christians. And not just Catholics, but people of all denominations were appalled by what they read. It is not just an account of transportation, but a lament for Ireland and her convicts sent from home. A vast and eloquent rendition of British policy as a pernicious cosmic evil. It is well worth remembering that at this time, the Christian conscience of England was turning upon the Atlantic slave trade, and much of this humane sentiment was now directed against the system of convict transportation. It is a curious fact that the Catholic mission in Australasia is a very rare book, despite being printed in vast numbers. And like a continental print run in four languages of 80,000 copies, that's big for the 19th century. This rarity indicates it was passed from hand to hand until literally read to pieces. I have actively sought out a copy for many years now and have not been able to purchase one for the collection. A single copy of the Sydney edition was sold at auction in 2018. But I foolishly missed this opportunity to buy it, which may never arise again, given the rarity of this colonial edition. And as far as sort of crimes against bibliography goes, that's a flogging crime, missing that one. This is what happened. This is the kind of things I think about when I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning. However, I am pleased to report that recently Bishop Foley of Cairns donated his personal copy of Ullathorne's Catholic Mission in Australasia to the university collection. Bishop Foley is a scholar and luminary, and we are deeply indebted to his generous donation. Bishop Foley's copy of Ullathorne's narrative is embedded within the annals of the propaganda for the year 1838, and that's the one that's circulating now in your hands. Okay, so William Ullathorne depicted the plight of the Irish convicts in a humane and sympathetic light, but other colonists were not so forgiving and paint a dramatically different picture. This brings us back to the issue raised previously. The Protestant ministers printed far more than their Anglican or Catholic counterparts. This skews the printed historical record against the Irish Catholic convict. Nonetheless, such vitriol printed against the Irish and against the church is still of great value in gauging the tone of colonial society. It may be unsettling to read material depicting the Irish as morally and constitutionally inferior, but this was the message spread from Presbyterian, Calvinist, and other Protestant pulpits for decades during the era of transportation. It is not my intention to depict Australian history in terms of a naive moral binary based upon religion. There is already a well-worn and enduring narrative that paints the Irish as the persecuted minority, as strangers in a strange land beset by cruelty and affliction. This same narrative posits the Protestants as middle-class free settlers, sanctimonious and condescending in their approach to morality and religion. Such simplification quickly devolves into a naive juxtaposition of Catholic ecclesiastics as frontline missionaries to the seemingly irredeemable and Scottish Presbyterians as self-serving adherents of an essentially blinkered, parochial and grasping middle class bent on materialistic aspirations. Such a clear-cut binary is simply not accurate, for there were generous and progressive people on both sides of the divide. But it is easy to see how such a simplistic division has evolved from the heated ephemeral printing generated by Protestant ministers. 2 points are significant at this juncture. First of all, it is important to understand the Protestant position in terms of the historical conditions of the period. Protestant settlers in New South Wales during the first decades of the 19th century struggled to form and propagate a moral community in a social environment they experienced as immoral. And I think it really is worth reflecting on the idea of how do you propagate a moral community. It's a really interesting idea. Anthropologically, it's a really interesting idea. So they experienced Sydney Town as immoral, and more than just immoral, colonial society was in many ways an inversion of right and wrong. Amongst the mass of the population, sobriety was a rarity, rum formed a currency of exchange, marriage vows meant little, prostitution was rife, violence and intimidation was normal, and lies and perjury commonplace. significant personal fortunes could be made from the rich resources and opportunities afforded in the colony, but it was a tough place to live. Ullathorne makes a very interesting point about perjury. He says that when men are chained together and forced to work together for weeks and months on end, that even if they don't like each other, that they will cover and lie to a magistrate if one of them is brought before a magistrate for a flogging. And the whole issue of perjury in colonial New South Wales, I think, is a fascinating subject in and of itself, because in committing perjury, it's a violation not just of the power of the state in the form of the magistrate, but also a violation of the oath made upon the Bible. Anyway, that's just a digression, but I think it's an interesting one. Okay, so the second point at this sort of junction here, so the second point that I want to make is the issue of personal charisma and ministers of religion. In any small community, the nature and tone of religious observation is heavily influenced by the personality of the men who preach. This was certainly the case in the Australian colonies. For the most part, the early Catholic priests were charismatic, but not inflammatory people. They could not afford to vex the governors, who were wary of their influence over the Irish section of the population. Conversely, Protestant preachers were typically charismatic, influential, and fearless. The Presbyterian community in Sydney was dominated for decades from the mid-1820s by the Reverend John Dunmore Lang, whose very large sculpture is actually just outside this church in the park. An irascible and energetic Scotsman, Dunmore Lang did more to fuel sectarian strife in colonial New South Wales than any other man. He spoke incessantly, preached with fiery conviction, meddled in politics, fathered a large family. He organised initiation initiatives and was repeatedly sued and jailed for libel in the course of his long and eventful life. For over half a century, Dunmore Lang taunted and provoked the Irish Catholics of the colony. He printed dozens upon dozens of books and pamphlets, often to promote his schemes for the emigration of upright and industrious Englishmen and Scots to Australia. Dunmore Lang was convinced of the inferiority of the Irish and their religion, and routinely depicts them as not only immoral, but criminally inclined. Furthermore, he accuses the Irish of loyalty to Rome. And with these accusations spread fear of covert sedition and disloyalty to British rule. Just one pamphlet gives a sense of Dunmore Lang's political agenda. Published in 1841 by James Tegg in Sydney, the pamphlet is titled "The Question of Questions!" Or is the colony to be transformed into a province of the Popedom? A letter delivered to the Protestant landholders of New South Wales by John Dunmore Lang, Doctor of Divinity. It comprises some 61 pages of verbose and scandalous anti-Irish racism and anti-Catholic bigotry, all of which is mixed up in a description of Lang's scheme for emigrating worthy mechanics from Scotland. I'm giving John Dunmore Lang a bit of a roasting here, but it's well worth noting that so much of the skilled labour that actually wound up in New South Wales was a result of his immigration schemes, and many of the fabulous buildings around us right now were built by those Scots. So, you know, he was incessantly active in so many ways that not all of it was bad. Okay, so far I've acquired almost 40 original Dunmore Lang pamphlets, broadsides and books for the collection at the Australian Catholic University. So I believe that material printed by enemies of the Catholic Church is just as historically important as records left by defenders of the faith. There are other eminent libraries of Catholic history in Australia, notably the Veitch Library in Strathfield, the Dalton McCorkey Jesuit Collection in Melbourne, and the magnificent Benedictine Library at New Norcia. But these are collections assembled by Catholic priests for the education and illumination of the faithful. Accordingly, it is unsurprising that the Protestant vitriol that fascinates historians is conspicuously absent from their shelves. So doubtless some of you would have seen the Veitch collection, and the sort of pamphlets that I'm talking about are very clearly not there. I don't think it's that the priests, senior ecclesiastics, and the bishops were not reading this Protestant vitriol. I imagine that they certainly did read it, but it got flicked into the fire after. You know, there's no prerogative to retain it. And it's significant that it's not present in the Veitch collection, which comprises, amongst other things, the personal libraries of the New South Wales bishops going back to Poling. So I just mention all of that because when I started doing this role, I had to sort of think laterally about not replicating a collection that already exists. Anyhow, for some time I earnestly believed that Dunmore Lang held the record for the most inflammatory rhetoric in the colony. This was until I had the good fortune to acquire a fabulous rarity by the Reverend Barzillai Quaife. That's right, Barzillai Quaife. This sounds like a made-up name, but please be assured it's not, and it's not a fiction of my imagination. And I actually rang, there's an excellent bookseller called Jonathan who works for Douglas Stewart in Melbourne, and he's a veteran bibliophile. He actually wears a Dickensian grey sort of jacket. He's the real deal. And I called him up and I said, "Have you got any books? Have you ever heard of Barzillai Quaife?" And he said, "What is this? It sounds like a progressive 80s rock band or something like that." And if Jonathan has never heard of this man, you get a sense of just how rare these things are. They're proper rare books. And they're rare because he printed them himself. He paid for them himself out of his own money. And you'll see at the bottom of the title page of that one in John's hand, printed for the author. So these are books that are printed and not published. That's a very significant bibliographic distinction. Anyhow, the Reverend Quaife was a congregational missionary in New Zealand until arriving in Sydney in 1844, where he came under the influence of Dunmore Lang and commenced preaching to the Scottish Presbyterian congregation in Parramatta and Sydney Town. During the late 1840s, he printed a small number of books at his own expense, one of which is titled Lectures on the Prophecy and Kingdom of Christ, delivered in the Scots Church, Macquarie Street, Sydney. The book is dated 1848. So when I got it, it was completely dilapidated, but I've had it rebound by Isabel, my bookbinder. And I was pretty much convinced that I was the only person this century to have actually read the book. And believe me, it's not an easy read. But it turns out that while Isabel was binding it, her dad read it as well. So we've now got two people who have read this book in the past, since 1848. And I'm delighted to announce that I've just been offered another book by Barzillai Quaife when he was back in England. And it's called A Memento for the Afflicted, which will be gripping reading. The sad thing is I will read it. Okay. Dunmore Lang was so heavily invested in the day-to-day catfighting of colonial politics that he rarely paused to clarify the theological motivations for his anti-Catholic position. Conversely, Barzillai Quaife was concerned with providing a deep explanation for his congregation. In doing so, he provides historians with an extraordinary insight into mid-19th century Protestant Presbyterian thinking. For Quaife, there could be only one ruler and one principality, namely the imminent kingdom of the resurrection of Christ. This means that all organized religion, all principalities and all forms of government were bogus and fraudulent perversions of power. The following quotation gives a sense of his enthusiasm, and I quote, "Yet although entirely spiritual in its essence, Christ's kingdom will comprise and control everything related to human conduct. Hence the outward forms of society will undergo a vast and radical change, being regenerated by the same influence which governs and sanctifies the inner man. All that is inconsistent with gospel principles in the polity of states must be abrogated. From this highly spiritual and purifying influence of evangelical piety, it will inevitably result that every government and political institution in actual existence will have to be either dissolved or expurgated, for there is not one which does not contain elements at utter variance with the undisturbed working of Christian truth and with the perfect liberty of all men to serve God without let or discouragement in righteousness and holiness." This is an extraordinary philosophical position for a Christian minister to promote, for it effectively encourages disobedience of temporal law and government. It's an even more extraordinary position to take in a convict colony, which is, if not autocratic, more of the autocratic, you know, it's not... Colonial New South Wales, during the period of transportation, is a long way from a democracy. And so it's really quite an extraordinary thing that this man was pounding this out from the pulpit to large groups of people, and he got away with it, as did Dunmore Lang. In any case. But Quaife was not content with merely rendering government and statesmen superfluous. He goes further and insists that the ultimate temporal kingdom is the Catholic Church. And this is where it gets really interesting. Quaife asserts that the Vatican is anti-Christian, and from here the Pope himself is deemed to be an anti-Christian emperor. With a little wordplay and truncation, the Pope is actually charged by Quaife as the Antichrist. These are fiery words indeed, and it is hard to imagine a more inflammatory rhetoric could be possible. I sort of get the feeling, like in comparing John Dunmore Lang and Barzilai Quaife, that John Dunmore Lang was politically a very astute man, and he was very conscious of the fact that he was talking to a congregation of people. In reading that book, sections of it sound like the actual audience has gone, and it's just Barzilai talking directly with God. It's a pretty hectic book. Okay. Reverend Quaife had an exhaustive command of the Bible, and he mines the Old Testament and the Gospel for proof of his conviction. He was especially fascinated by abstract numerological connections in the prophecies, and whole sections of his book are uncomfortably reminiscent of contemporary internet conspiracy theories and millenarian paranoia. When reading Reverend Quaife's extraordinary book, I was reminded of King Solomon's maxim that what has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again, for verily there is nothing new under the sun. Folks, I'm running over my allocated time for this presentation. I had intended to talk about the eventual evolution of the relatively peaceful and inclusive society that we enjoy in Australia today. But that is a whole topic unto itself. And it really is an interesting topic. I can't imagine a less auspicious way to start a nation than dumping the unwanted of Great Britain here. And somehow it's worked out okay. And sort of thinking about it anthropologically in terms of some of these issues of personal charisma in Protestant evangelism and so on and so forth, the obvious frame of reference is the United States and how it has turned out not okay relative to the relatively tranquil and non-violent society that we have here. So these are all sort of interesting things to think about. But we could talk till the cows come home about this. Anyway, so wrapping up. The social environment began to change dramatically when transportation ceased and the Victorian gold rushes of the early 1850s lured Irish miners from California to the Australian fields. Emboldened Irishmen from North America gave confidence to their downtrodden Australian counterparts, and events such as the Eureka Stockade were the result. From a more durable political perspective, the Irish, made wealthy by gold and associated economic growth, soon attained political representation. The parliamentary career of Charles Gavan Duffy, formerly an Irish radical and student of Daniel O'Connell, is one such example. I would like to leave you with one final thought, that both Catholic and Protestant religious observance in colonial Australia was radical and unconventional. The Catholic mission to the convicts was extraordinarily intense, for it effectively offered salvation to those persons discarded by conventional society. And the Protestant effort to assert moral control in a radically disordered society was based upon a wholesale rejection of institutional power at all levels. I do hope that some of this has stimulated your curiosity, and would like to welcome members of the Catholic Historical Society to visit the new rare book collection at the Australian Catholic University campus in North Sydney. We now have a specially built room for the collection in the library, and this is organised for easy use by visitors and researchers. So in concluding this lecture, I would like to share a little of my experience in assembling it. While I have long-term experience with old books, I make no claim whatsoever, and none whatsoever, to possessing any real knowledge of Australian or Irish ecclesiastic history. About 2 or 3 years into building the collection, I laboured under the misunderstanding that I had acquired some handle on the subject. But now, after some 5 years have passed, I must concede that I really understand very little. And this may actually be a fruitful place to work from, as the Socratic paradigm reduces all knowledge to nothing anyhow. The point I'm trying to make is that I actually need your input to make this collection progressively better and better. This is why I want you to come and use the collection and talk to me about the research that you have unfolded over years and even decades of effort. In an age of digitisation when libraries and institutions are downsizing and discarding books, it is important that concerted and intelligent efforts are made to preserve rare printed material. So you can all be a part of this initiative, and for this reason I will be honoured to welcome you as guests to our collection. So I've handed around flyers on how to find me, and I'll be away next week on leave for Easter, but the following week after Easter, please give me a call. Okay, so this concludes my presentation. Thanks for your time and patience. And there's a few also little catalogues on the table there. They were catalogues that we printed in 2019 when the collection was actually officially launched at the university. But you get a bit of a sense of the spread of the material in there from that catalogue. Thank you. Oh, yeah, questions.
Well, are there questions or comments?
Thank you very much. That was indeed a great pleasure to listen about the collection, its value, and to the community as a whole. One of the problems that faces most of us is physical access. Mm-hmm. With the growth in digitization, is there any long-term program of making it more widely accessible through digitizing some of the precious and rare manuscripts and books?
Absolutely.
That's one of the problems that we face consistently, sure. Particularly given the pandemic and the problems of being able to move and access these research collections, valuable as they are.
There's a significant proportion, probably 20% or so of the collection has already been digitised. Hopefully that will increase and progress in the future. But it's a very time-consuming and extraordinarily expensive thing to do. But, you know, for the past 5 years, my efforts have largely gone into just acquiring enough material so it's actually a viable collection. It is the intention of the university to digitise the whole lot, or at least digitise the material that is not readily available via the State Library, National Library, or other much larger institutional collections that have a vastly greater budget for digital access.
The University of New South Wales, which is where I worked, and I've been in the information business, I think it's terrific that we all have collections, but the problem of physical access is always there, and then you ask yourself, well, who are we serving, why are we serving, and why is it not more readily and easily available to a wider audience? No. And it doesn't have to, you don't have to be an academic, and you can access it any time of the night, day, or any part of the globe. So, I mean, this has been on my mind since I first started work in the reading room of the Mitchell Library. This is nearly 50 years ago.
It's sort of like, you know, like I work there 3 days a week, and I'm not a librarian, and I make a very specific point that I'm not a librarian. And the whole issue of digital access is, it's a big one, and I have only a certain amount of time, and my emphasis is basically on actually having real books in a real room that real people can really come and look at, and whether or not the institution outside of me wants to invest in digitising is beyond my control. I hope they do, but without that room full of books, there's nothing to work with. But it is accessible. Like, you can come in and you can browse the shelves, and you can't do that in other rare book libraries. So that's sort of what I've got, is I've just got slabs of books, and they're all in one place.
That was a very interesting lecture. Thank you so much. Are you only interested in things from last century, from the 1800s, or are you looking for things from the 1900s? What's your period that you are?
Look, the date range is pretty broad. It goes right up to, you know, right now, basically. But the, you know, given that the time, money and resources are limited, my focus really is on the 19th century. I've got a lot of good material from the eras of Mannix through to a lot of good stuff from First and Second World War, so on and so forth. All but one of Father John Kennedy's novels, for example. So there's no sort of expiration date on the date range. As for the early end of it, I said in my presentation that it starts with the La Perouse priests, but I've actually got books that are significantly earlier than that. There are utopian fictions which are often enmeshed in European sectarian conflict that involve the Antipodes, and so I've got some of those. And they are late 17th century, so that's the sort of date range. But most of my energy is in the first half of the 19th century. Yeah.
Jeff?
I'm not quite sure how to ask the question, but you've talked mainly about books, and you've mentioned the early Irish convicts tend to be people who weren't all that brilliant. Mm. One of the people that I accidentally came across as a result of a question that I was asked was James Meehan.
Yeah.
Now, he probably hasn't written anything, but he certainly produced a lot of maps and those sorts of things. Are you interested in artefacts and maybe people like James Meehan and the contribution they made to the development of the colony?
Absolutely, I am. And the, one of many things I wanted to do is to sit down and work out which of the cartographic engravers in Sydney and Hobart were emancipated Irish Catholic convicts. It wouldn't be that hard to do. It just is a very time-consuming project to take up. But yes, by all means, maps and such objects. Clifford Craig wrote an excellent series of books. The veteran collector, now long gone, Clifford Craig wrote an excellent series of books on the convict engravers of Van Diemen's Land, and I bought them with the intention of actually pursuing that as a way to source out material. So cartography, start to finish, from the process of surveying, I bought them with the intention of actually pursuing that as a way to source out material. So cartography, exploration, and then the actual printing and making of maps. Yes, to answer your question.
I was interested that you referred to Bishop James Foley in Cairns. I don't know him, but I have a feeling that I knew his father, because his father, Tom, was a broadcaster on horse racing in Brisbane, and my father knew him well and listened to him devotedly. And there he produces a son who ends up a bishop. So you can't tell where bishops will come from.
You mentioned a particular volume that had slipped through your hands. Was it one of Ullathorne's?
Yeah, that's the one I didn't get was the Sydney edition of The Catholic Mission in Australasia. So, what's there in the embedded in the annals of the propaganda. So, I've really gone to town on the bibliography of this one book, and there are Dublin, there are editions Liverpool, London, Dublin. Richard Coyne publishes it in Dublin, and he is the publisher to Maynooth. Then it gets distributed on the continent in the four languages, and then it's reissued as The Horrors of Transportation. And then Ullathorne comes back to Sydney and has it printed in Sydney. And it's a terrible mistake for him to do that in the colony, because so much of the economy of the economy is running on indentured labour that he makes a lot of enemies very quickly. And it shortens his time here. It makes it increasingly difficult for him to minister in the colony, his decision to print that particular book. And it was offered for sale at auction in Melbourne a couple of years ago, but I didn't know as much as I did. I wasn't knowledgeable. I wasn't looking for this particular book at that time. And I probably will never see it again. It's a really, really rare book. Ullathorne published 5 pamphlets in Sydney. In 5 years, I bought one, his reply to Judge Burton. I bought it on eBay, in fact, but I had to send it back because it was incomplete. And I don't want to start collecting incomplete books because that's an unhappy path to go down. But they're really, really hard to get, surprisingly hard to get. And so...
Would you consider trying to get a facsimile copy?
No. Like, you can get... The National Library has printed a facsimile of this book, and it exists digitally and so on and so forth. But like I was saying in relation to the previous question, my concern is actual physical copies of the really rare books. And it's sort of, you know, and while I'm very sympathetic to the principle of digitisation, because in this device are more books than in the Library of Congress 100 times over or 1,000 times over. The fact that nobody ever reads them online is another issue altogether. But in terms of the broader history of the Catholic Church, which for 2,000 years, if we count that history from the inception of the apostolic succession, has been very, very much concerned with the physical preservation of books and manuscripts. Some destruction, but mostly preservation. And we literally live in an era where, you know, fabulous, amazing libraries are discarded. Like, if any of you saw what happened to Fisher Library 13 years ago. And so my emphasis is really the focus on the best copies of the rarest books for the lowest prices. And this is why it's significant that I've been able to do this as a former rare book dealer, because librarians are not necessarily sensitive to the condition of books. And I have really beautiful... Book collectors are incredibly obsessed with the condition of books. Librarians are largely disinterested. Sorry, Paul. It's a terrible slight to you. But...
Not all of them.
Not all of them. But, that's basically what I'm doing, is I'm just staying focused on books of physical things and, one day if there is no electricity because the apocalypse has come, then the books will still exist and this will be useless. So there you go.
Well, on that cheerful note...
let's have some Anzac biscuits.
I think we might have a cup of tea or coffee. But Hugh has made all sorts of very interesting comments about the importance of books and printed material in the way we perceive history and the generation of later and subsequent books. And I'm conscious of the ending of the book of Ecclesiastes, which says, of many books there is... writing many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. But it's the only sort of weariness that's virtuous. And as you were talking about the locus of those books, I was reminded of the first time that I ever went to the NUD reorganised manuscripts library at the National Library of Australia, which was on the second floor of that building, looking north over the lake, the Black Mountain there. And there, my first day, and I thought, here am I trying to do a little bit of research, and the person who sat next to me introduced himself to me as Manning Clark.
And I felt pretty good.
I thought, I'm not as famous as he is, but I'm legitimate. So thank you very much, Hugh.
Thank you.
We've been listening to the Rare Books Librarian at the Australian Catholic University, Hugh Myers, speak about historical perspectives from the newly formed collection of rare books and manuscripts at the ACU. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. The ACHS podcast is recorded and produced by me, John Kenny. There'll be another history talk in the crypt of St. Patrick's Church Hill on the afternoon of the 15th of May 2022, when Gerard Windsor will speak about Writing Australian Catholic History, a Case Study, Riverview. The speaker is a novelist, literary critic, essayist, and a former Ducks of Riverview College. Among his many works is The Tempest-Tossed Church. We look forward to having you along for that talk. Until then, please stay well.